I'm Marty Moscoen, and this is Radio Times in Review, our weekly show when we go back into our archives and highlight some of the best conversations from Radio Times past. Today on the show, we're going to explore the role that money plays in our political system. We'll hear from Jane Mayer, journalist and staff writer for The New Yorker. She spent years investigating how the Koch brothers became such big spenders. We'll also listen to my interview with Matea Gold, who covers money and politics for The Washington Post. We talked about the Supreme Court decisions that have fueled so much spending and their impact on government. But first, we'll play some of my conversation with Zephyr Teachout about efforts to prevent political corruption. She's a candidate for the U.S. Congress from New York and a law professor. That's all coming up when Radio Times in Review continues after the news from NPR. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us today. We're talking about money in politics this hour, and we begin by listening to my conversation with Zephyr Teachout. She's running for Congress in New York's 19th District and has made ending corruption the bedrock of her platform. This has long been a concern of hers and something she has taught as a professor of law at Fordham University. She joined us last year to discuss her book, Corruption in America, From Benjamin Franklin's Snuffbox to Citizens United, which delves into the many efforts to prevent money from influencing our democracy. Let's take a listen. Let's go back to France and King Louis XVI and Benjamin Franklin, and even the founders of this country. What were they grappling with when it came to writing the Constitution and thinking about corruption in government and money?
Well, in a lot of ways, corruption was the animating danger at the Constitutional Convention, and not just the convention, but during that time as we were building this new country. And so they actually talked about corruption and thought about corruption and worried about corruption all the time.
Well, and I wonder, too, going back to the founders, how did they define corruption? And I think over time we've contracted and expanded the definition. How do they see corruption?
You know, it was so much part of their language. And I think you can think of this of anything that's so deeply part of your language. You don't sit around and define it if you're used to it. You know, people use the words, you know, whether democracy or love, words that are an essential part of your grammar. You're less likely to debate or define. So you don't see debates about it. But what you can conclude from all the discussions is that they were, one, very clearly not just talking about criminal law bribery. We know that in part because there really wasn't very much criminal law bribery, but also that wasn't those weren't the examples they were using. What they were talking about is when those with public power serve private ends, are greedy, instead of serving the public good. I know, and I've talked to a lot of people about how, you know, that sounds fuzzy at the margins.
It does.
It's difficult to apply in a particular instance, but that's true of all of our really important concepts like free speech or federalism. I argue that corruption is a concept like that with that kind of weight that's difficult to define at the margins, but the deep ambition is the ambition to protect against selfish, self-serving, greedy people in public power.
I'm curious about what happened when Benjamin Franklin came back to the United States with this snuff box. And you write about this.
Yeah, well, it was one of many gifts that the King of France had given to various diplomats. And we had actually an acting provision. This is pre-constitutional provision that was based on something from the Netherlands, which said that you had to you could not accept these kinds of gifts. And this provision was so outside of the norm that actually one writer said it was against the law of nations.
Oh, wow.
That, you know, everybody gives gifts in diplomacy. That's what we do. But actually, the initial constitution didn't include it. And then it was re-included because the framers thought it was so important to protect against these kind of gifts. And I want to explain why. The fear was not that the king was bribing Franklin. It wasn't that he sort of said, here's a snuff box, and next time you get a chance, insert a positive provision in our trade deal. The concern is that it would actually affect Franklin's sentiments. And he would be
his feelings.
His feelings. And so that when he was in a position to negotiate with France or to talk about foreign policy, he would think so favorably, he might be blinded to his own sort of sentimental attachments, and that that itself is a form of corruption. And I think they're very subtle about their understandings of things that could corrupt us. We don't always see them. They're not always brazen. But it would lead to him not serving the public good, instead serving the French interest. And so then in our Constitution, we do have this provision forbidding taking a gift of any kind whatsoever from a foreign power for those holding office. And, you know, it was honored in the breach from time to time, but it still was an important principle. It was saying we as Americans are different. We are stricter. We are afraid of gifts, actually. We are afraid that gifts can corrupt politics.
But we do know that leaders and monarchs do still give gifts, for instance, to the president. I don't know. Are they just kept in a gigantic warehouse somewhere?
Well, to be clear, you're allowed to keep the gift if Congress gives permission. And actually, this really bothered Thomas Jefferson. So Jefferson, I love as a character because he's sort of our favorite hypocrite. He both holds up the highest standards and then violates those standards. That's certainly true with slavery. Also true with this gift-giving provision. And now he was very strict about these questions of gifts and corruption. Yet when he himself later was given a diamond-encrusted gift, At first, he tried to resist it because he just didn't want the embarrassment of going in front of Congress to ask permission to keep it. And then he didn't resist it, but told his assistant to take all the diamonds out, sell them, and put the money towards his own account. And he hid the whole affair entirely.
Why does that have a kind of familiar ring to
yes.
it, right? But this is, I guess, human nature up against these values, right?
Yeah. And I actually think that's why the rules are so important. Not because even the best among us might not violate them, but because they're kind of speed limits on our own ethical obligations. Maybe I'm mixing metaphors too much there, but these rules give us guideposts about, wait a second, we might be actually overstepping the bounds. And if there's clear lines saying this is ethically acceptable and this isn't, that helps us serve our public better.
I do want to get to the 20th century and even the 21st century talking about this, but just spend a little bit of time on the 19th century, which we do think of as a time of robber barons and the building of the railroads and the various scandals associated with this expanding country. How do you see that fitting in?
Oh, there's so much really interesting history. So you have this Constitution built around protecting against corruption. And Mason said, if we don't protect against corruption, we will soon be at an end. And Hamilton said, you know, when asked about what we did at the Constitutional Convention, he wrote, erected every practicable obstacle against corruption. So they saw this as this anti-corruption document. And then, of course, the country begins with a scandal. And one of the first scandals that really occupied our country, actually for decades, was the Yazoo scandal. So in Yazoo, the Yazoo lands in western Georgia were sold for basically pennies on the acre, what somebody called the real estate deal of the century. The legislature of Georgia allowed this sale, and over half of the legislators actually had stock and had a financial interest in the sale themselves. So the people of Georgia were understandably very upset. They'd lost this major asset. Kicked out every single legislator, set fire to the law that had granted this land to these private companies. They
literally
had a bonfire, passed a new law saying that law is void, and then assumed that they owned the land. But there was this legal question, and my research is really about the law, less about the scandals necessarily are part of it, but it was like, what does corruption mean? How does corruption work in law? How does this difficult concept work in law? So the legal question, which is really tricky, is a law not a law because it was passed corruptly? Is a law not a law because over 50% of the legislators were bribed? Or can you overturn those laws? And that's, you know, you can understand why that's a really tricky question for the courts. The Supreme Court Justice Marshall ended up deciding that it was just too difficult to figure out in any given case whether a law had been passed corruptly or not. And so upheld the sale.
But I wonder whether the fact that so many of these legislators were kicked out, whether it's the the courts or the law says, well, then the voters step in and they, in a sense, void the law.
Well, election helps, but it doesn't help so much if you've already lost all your assets. And so that was why it was a tricky question. But in response to that and several other scandals, you see the rise of something that was relatively new at the time, which is these criminal bribery laws. Because actually, when that happened in Georgia, there were none of those legislators could be put in jail because there was no laws against legislative bribery. So you see a rise of criminal bribery laws, and then you also see the rise of a real concern around lobbying.
Mm.
And really for 80 years of our history, lobbying was either illegal or against the public policy of the states. It was a felony in California. The 1877 Constitution of Georgia included lobbying as a crime in the Constitution. And, you know, my favorite stories actually involve the court cases around lobbying, though.
There was a very important case in the 20th century, the Buckley-Vilelo?
Buckley versus Vilelo.
Vilelo.
In 1976.
Which kind of set the stage for this idea that speech and money were somehow connected.
Yeah. I like to joke that, you know, Benjamin Franklin said that our country would last a couple hundred years, but we didn't think he'd be so precise because Buckley versus Vilelo was 1976. And in that case, the Supreme Court struck down parts of a federal law that was designed to do something about campaign finance. This is in the sort of post-Watergate era. It actually, the Supreme Court upheld laws that limited how much you could contribute to a candidate, but struck down the laws that limited how much you could spend on a campaign. And you have to understand how unusual this is. In Europe, there's limitations on how much you can spend, not just how much you can contribute. And it did so because it said, you know, spending money is First Amendment protected speech in this context.
Is that making the connection between lobbyists? I mean, people who get paid to express an opinion to our elected officials?
Yes. So that case wasn't actually about lobbying, but it did epitomize a view that political speech is the most protected speech and money spent around political speech is the most protected speech.
And that's where we are today.
And that's where we are today.
Are we talking about then legal corruption? I mean, I don't even know if that phrase exists.
And I actually think if you talk to people anywhere in the country except the Supreme Court, they talk about corruption in this way. I think the Supreme Court has gone off on this very narrow idea that it's, you know, it's got to be criminal law bribery. But I think people feel very comfortable calling a situation corrupt, even if nobody's going away in handcuffs.
Does it also raise questions about perhaps Congress not playing its role as the third branch of government? Is there something you think Congress could do to not just challenge the court, but also to raise some of these issues?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, there's other things that are happening now. For one, you see over 50% of Congress members are now becoming lobbyists after they leave office. And actually, the framers were concerned about a variation of this. They called it the problem of placemen, people who would go into office, go into elected office in order to get an appointed office from the king. And so the problem was they would basically just serve the king instead of serving their constituencies. Now we have the problem of placemen, but it's people serving their future employers, serving the lobbyists that they're going to work for. And we could certainly do more with the revolving door. And, you know, members of Congress, I think, are realizing that most Americans are opposed to Citizens United. And so many have come forward supporting a constitutional amendment. But what they could do is actually change the way that campaigns are funded. And they're scared to do it because it changes what their jobs are. You know, they're used to their job of being fundraiser, basically, you know, the job of being a congressperson now is basically the job of being a salesperson.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money. That's what I want.
That was my 2015 conversation with law professor and candidate for U.S. Congress, Zephyr Teachout, author of Corruption in America. When we get back from the break, we'll follow the money with Matea Gold. Stay with us.
But your love won't pay my bills. I want money. That's what I want.
Yeah. I don't have an ego, but my money do. And I don't have a big mouth, but my money do.
Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We continue our hour on money in politics by listening to my discussion with Washington Post reporter Matea Gold. She tracks fundraising, spending, and their influence on our current political system and what effect they have on governance. She joined us earlier this year to discuss her work following the money, super PACs, and to share some of her thoughts on the current presidential election. Let's listen. So how much do you think it will cost, add up all the costs, the various candidates to run for president?
Well, I think it's actually a much harder figure to pin down this cycle because, as we mentioned, Trump has such an unconventional candidacy. It might not need to invest in the kinds of traditional means of communicating that we've seen in the past. I would expect that, you know, he and the RNC together are going to have to muster somewhere in the neighborhood of $300 to $500 million, and that outside groups will probably spend another $500 million to $1 billion. Wow. But, you know, a lot of what we've seen this cycle is sort of a diminishing return on investment by some of these independent groups and super PACs. So while I don't think that will slow down the spending rate in this fall, I do think that there is a real question growing among political strategists on both sides of the aisles about the merits of making these huge television investments.
And the idea that and that's where most of the money goes, right? It's on our TV screens.
That is still the primary source of where all of these resources are spent. And it still is the most effective way to communicate with people. I mean, if you want to get mass media and reach the most people, even though people don't watch commercials in the way they used to, you still have a better chance if you buy an ad on local or national television of reaching the numbers you want to reach. And that is starting to change with digital targeting, and people are able to buy kind of precise views and demographics online now. But it's still slowly moving that direction.
Even though once you get really close to an election, it feels like if you turn – it's almost – people are almost afraid to turn their TV on because they're just going to get a barrage of ads.
And I think especially here in Pennsylvania, you're going to be hit with just a real deluge between the Senate race and the presidential. I mean, more than ever, this is a state that I think will figure it prominently, obviously, in the 2016 calculus for the presidential candidate.
Both nationally and there's some Absolutely. Local races, I think, that they could flip either way.
And that's when I think we're going to see even more of an investment on the ground as well. And we're already seeing a huge number of organizations really peeling out throughout, I think, especially the Philadelphia suburbs, who will be key in knocking on doors. And I think a lot of people are probably going to have to keep their doors closed if they want to avoid all the solicitations that come after dinner.
Let's talk a little bit about Hillary Clinton and does she need similar amounts of money compared to Donald Trump?
I think it's an open question. I mean, she is, I think, hoping to raise close to $1 billion in conjunction with the party. You know, we'll see if there'll probably be another, $400 million to $1 billion spent on behalf of her by outside groups, including a network of super PACs that is raising money for her. I think she is pursuing a much more conventional approach. Clearly, she's already running these traditional television ads, and that's something that is going to be very costly. But she also has an advantage that Trump doesn't have in that she has a network of fundraisers and what we call bundlers, people who bring together checks, who have been doing this for decades for both her and her husband, former President Bill Clinton. And they have an operation in place to bring in huge sums of money. That is something that Trump and the RNC are just beginning to try to set up right now. And I think that there's a lot of resistance, at least among traditional players in the fundraising field and in the Republican side, to giving and supplying him with money.
Traditional players like what, the Koch brothers or a Koch brother?
Well, the Koch network has actually said as of now they're not going to get involved in the presidential campaign. But I'm actually speaking more of sort of the longtime party fundraisers who are so key to tapping their networks and bringing in these large checks. And really, the one of the most expensive things is putting on what they call a victory operation, which is party finance field offices all over the country to really identify and get out your voters. And that, much more than I think media in the final weeks of the campaign, is what's going to matter.
Well, there's the Trump, I guess, the Clinton victory funds, the possibility you have figured out and others have figured out that one donor could give as much as $358,800 to Clinton. One donor could give $449,400 to Donald Trump. I thought we had, you know, is this because of Citizen United, McCutcheon, other Supreme Court rulings?
Yeah, I mean, really what we've seen is the return to big money in the political parties in the cycle in a way that we have not seen since the 1990s when, as you may recall, there was this landmark campaign finance overhaul, the McCain-Feingold Act, which curtailed the amount of large donations that parties could take in. And this was in response to huge fundraising excesses of the Clinton administration. There were questions about whether foreign money had ended up in the coffers of party committees. The response to that was to really clamp down on how much money parties can raise. But we've seen a couple things happen that have changed the abilities of parties to be able to bring in big dollars. One was the McCutcheon decision by the Supreme Court in 2014, which gets much less attention than Citizens United, but has had a dramatic impact on the parties. What McCutcheon did was do away what was called an aggregate limit on how much someone could give to federal candidates and parties in 1 year.
An annual cap.
Exactly. So, you know, I think it was about $112,000 in the last cycle. And basically what it said was, you know, you could give a limited amount to a candidate in a party, but once you hit that total cap, you couldn't give any more. An Alabama businessman named Sean McCutcheon challenged that and said, this is a violation of my First Amendment rights. I should be able to support as many candidates and as many political committees as I'd like. And the Supreme Court agreed with that. And so the cap was done away with. And in the process, the Obama administration, in arguing that case, argued, you know, this could really lead us down the path in which we see these huge joint fundraising committees formed. So party committees pool together lots of different candidate committees and ask donors to write one big check altogether. And that could put a donor in the position of being able to write a check of $1 million or more. That was something that Justice Alito dismissed as a wild hypothetical. But interestingly, we're one cycle in, we're already seeing that happen now. And Secretary Clinton was actually the first to take advantage of this new freedom. And she set up a joint fundraising committee with the Democratic Party last year, along with 32 state committees, the biggest joint fundraising committee we've ever seen. And they can take in $356,000, I believe, annually from a donor. On top of that, the party can actually solicit money for these additional funds that Congress slipped into an appropriations bill at the end of 2014, which has also greatly expanded the ability of the parties to take in large dollars.
And that has gotten a lot of attention. And this is a way to pay for things like conventions and legal bills, stuff like that.
Exactly. So what happened was, first, Congress actually, and Obama signed a law diverting public money that used to go to the conventions. This was something that went, it was rediverted to research into pediatric cancer. And that convention funding wasn't very much. It was about $18 million a year, but it was enough to sort of provide a baseline for the parties to put on their quadrennial nominating convention. So the party leader said, look, we have to have a way to raise money for that. And so first they got the Federal Election Commission to agree to set up a separate, allow them to raise separately for the convention and money that wouldn't count against money that went to the party account. And then very last minute, behind closed doors, party leaders huddled in late of
both parties
together huddled in late 2014, and in the middle of this massive appropriations bill, they slipped in this new language that allowed the parties to each have three separate accounts: one to raise money for the national conventions, one to raise money for legal expenses, and another for covering the costs of headquarters and building expenses.
Do you think once people begin to see how much money is being raised and how it's being raised and from whom, there will be calls for some kind of reform or public financing?
There has been, without a doubt, an incredibly loud public reaction to this that I think we've really seen resonating for the first time in this election cycle. You know, all of the Republican candidates really had to address the issue of money and politics on the campaign trail, which was really a first. And obviously, it was a major issue on the Democratic side, and it's something that I think really propelled Senator Bernie Sanders' campaign. And so there's no question that there is a sense now that this is something the public wants to see changed and reformed. Now, what solutions will get traction is really the $6 million question. Public financing is something that we've seen pass in some local levels, some local jurisdictions such as New York City. Other jurisdictions are pursuing it. I don't know that the Democrats could get their Republican colleagues on the Hill to pass that on a federal level. But there are some steps to try to win bipartisan support for mm-hmm. at least measures of better disclosure and other smaller steps that they believe could at least start the ball rolling.
But it still goes back to the Supreme Court. Their ruling, Buckley v. Valeo, several decades ago, basically saying that money, you know, that you can't separate money and speech.
Exactly. And that 1976 decision was so seminal because it really bifurcated the political money. Basically, it said the Supreme Court said you could regulate money that goes directly to candidates and political parties, but money that is spent independently cannot be limited under the First Amendment. And that has informed all the decisions since then, obviously most dramatically Citizens United. You know, there's a huge effort on the left to try to overturn Citizens United, but many people who work on this issue feel that that's, one, not necessarily a realistic strategy, and two, wouldn't really solve all the issues of the way money is entering the system. So what solutions and what approach there will be to this in the next Congress is really going to be fascinating to watch, especially considering if the Democrats are able to retake the House, for example.
Do you think what the Republicans are doing or what Trump is doing is any different from what the Democrats are doing?
Well, what's interesting is I think that the emergence of wealthy donors as major players in both parties in some ways insulated them from what was clearly going on the ground among voters. And it furthered this sense of alienation that many people have from the political party establishments. And this has probably been most dramatic on the Republican side, what we're seeing with Donald Trump. But obviously the Sanders phenomena speaks to
Absolutely.
This as well. And so at the same time that sort of all the candidates and the parties were benefiting from the money that has been flowing into the system from wealthy donors, it is also sort of distracted and exacerbated this perception that the party leaders are very distant from the voters that they represent.
Well, and as we all know, Bernie Sanders raising millions of dollars. It was at $27 as the average donation to his campaign.
Yeah, and the Sanders phenomenon is incredible. I mean, it builds on something that we saw former Vermont Governor Howard Dean began, that John Kerry built on that, and obviously President Obama most successfully until Senator Sanders. But even President Obama, with his huge fundraising success, relied very heavily also on big checks and donors that gave the maximum to raise the amounts of money that he did. The Sanders phenomenon has been one that's built almost entirely through small donations. You know, they claim the average is $27 a donation. It's hard to sort of pin
that
down.
That.
But, you know, either way, there's no question that it's, you know, people who are repeatedly hitting that donate button online and giving $10, $20, $30 at a time. The fact that he could raise so much money outside the system powered by small donors, I think, has really caught the attention of everyone in politics and, you know, across the country. And also, I think, given Republicans' hope that Donald Trump will be able to do the same.
The Federal Election Commission, the FEC, is supposed to keep tabs on money and how these elections are conducted. Tell us about the FEC.
So
their problems, I guess.
One thing that has been remarkable covering the FEC now since the fall of 2010, since really the beginning of when the Citizens United decision started having an impact, is I think it's reached a new level of acrimony and personal animosity among the six commissioners. There are three Democratic appointees and three Republican appointees. That structure was set up so there wouldn't be really an ability of one party to sway a decision in their favor. But what's happened is it's led to just a complete paralysis on the commission in many ways. And so there is both, I think, a lot of personal tension among the commissioners, and there's just a real ideological divide on the role that the commission should play. The result is that the participants in politics feel liberated to take risks that I think we have never seen before.
Really?
I mean, one of the things that was so striking to me in covering the beginning of this election cycle was the liberties that the allies of the presidential candidates were taking in participating and setting up super PACs on their behalf. And super PACs are supposed to operate independently of the candidates and the parties. They're not supposed to coordinate strategy and a paid advertising strategy, I should clarify, with the candidates. But because the rules were actually written in a fairly limited way, and because the commission has not been very aggressive about enforcing those rules, we saw super PACs spring up, supporting nearly every single candidate run by their allies and people with close knowledge of what their goals and strategies would be. And in fact, in some cases, such as with Carly Fiorina and Bobby Jindal, the super PACs took the lead role in running the campaign for the candidates and actually put on events and sponsored the town hall meetings, and the candidates would
Which is a no-no, right?
Well, you know, it's the law is written vaguely enough that they actually had quite a bit of freedom in which to operate. And so, you know, the candidates would show up as guests at events put on by the super PACs. So the super PAC, which could accept unlimited donations from individuals and corporations, was able to subsidize effectively the costs of running for a presidency.
Wow. And is with something like that, does the FEC wait for someone to complain, or do they have to actively intervene if they see some kind of violation?
What we have seen is that the FEC waits for complaints to be filed, and typically those complaints are not getting addressed for years until after the cycle has passed. And so we actually just saw the FEC close a slew of cases related to the 2010 election cycle. So for many of political operatives, the risk of taking, you know, a bold move right now is pretty low, because by the time the FEC gets around to considering the case, many of these groups actually are long gone and have actually dissolved, and the operatives have moved on.
Does the FEC know it has this problem?
This is a subject of pretty intense debate at the FEC. There's been a lot of pretty emotional discussion on the commission about the role that they should play. A lot of the commissioners, I should say, have been there quite a long time, are actually serving expired terms. Part of the problem is the White House has not put forward new nominees for the commission, and that's something that they really need to do in conjunction with the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, who has a lot of influence over who gets nominated on the Republican side. So I think that has fallen down on the list of priorities at the White House, shall we say, and finding consensus with Mitch McConnell on that issue is not something they've really spent a lot of time doing since appointing. There were two nominees that got in during this administration, but that's been it.
Because basically it allows them to, both parties, to kind of do what they want to do, right? Without having to worry about the FEC?
I think that if you talk to President Obama about the Federal Election Commission, I imagine he would not be actually happy with the way that things are going there. But I don't know that it's been a top priority for his administration to address.
That was my conversation with Washington Post journalist Matea Gold, recorded earlier this year. When we get back, the role of the Koch brothers on our political system. Stay with us.
Money. Get away. Get a good job with more pay and you're okay. Money. It's a gas.
Money, money, money. Must be funny in the rich man's world.
Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoane. We'll conclude our hour of money in politics by talking about the biggest spenders in American politics, the Koch brothers, who have spent millions to get their preferred candidates elected from national offices to local races. We learn more about the Kochs when we were joined by investigative journalist Jane Mayer, staff writer for The New Yorker, who spent years digging into the family history. She compiled her findings in the book Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. Let's listen. Are we talking in many ways about a third kind of political party when we look at the Koch brothers and their political intent?
In many ways we are, which is what is really different at this point. I mean, we've always had rich Democrats and rich Republicans, but what we've got here is kind of a privatized political party that represents the interests of 400 to 500 of the richest businessmen in the country. They've pooled their money together. They've got more paid personnel than the Republican National Committee working for them. They've got a budget that's twice as big as what the Republican National Committee spent on the 2012 presidential campaign. So you've got a plutocratic party forming in the country.
And what do they want?
They want to influence America so that it goes in the direction of their own chosen policies. And they, instead of running for office, they are trying to use their fortunes to pressure the political process and bring it in their direction. So low taxes, anti-government sort of, you know, attitudes that will cut social policies that are expensive for this group to fund, and they don't need, you know, social policies, obviously, and to try to get rid of regulations and laws that have butted against their own businesses.
This book, in many ways, is about the Koch brothers, but it's also about Richard Mellon Scaife and some other family names or business names that people may or may not be familiar with. Would it be fair to say that the Kochs are leading this charge?
Well, they are now. I mean, and they are kind of one of a kind, almost. I have a quote from someone named Charles Lewis, who runs a nonprofit organization, bipartisan, called the Center for Public Integrity. And he says of the Kochs, they're in a league of their own. They've got such a history of political manipulation and of law breaking, but also just really interesting ambitions ideologically. I mean, they come from such an obscurely far-right place, and they have over 40 years spent their fortune trying to bring America in their direction. And it's definitely moved the ball a lot. So they're unusual. But I'm glad you asked about – you mentioned the others, because what I wanted to do in this book was write about how there are actually a handful of these families, ultra-conservative, ultra-wealthy families, who started building a kind of an opposition – private opposition to America's government beginning in the 1970s. And they've been funding a kind of a counter-establishment with their own, you know, organizations, think tanks, all of these things to kind of create opinion that will push things in their direction.
Well, let's go back to the, 1930s, to Fred Koch, the father of the brothers, who are the ones we will be talking mostly about. He made his money in what looks like fossil fuels or the oil industry. You also write in this book that he had business deals with Stalin, also with Hitler's Nazi Germany.
Yeah, it's a tremendous irony, really, for a family that's been known as the primary funders of libertarianism, meaning sort of small government. The family fortune's roots were in working for some of the most tyrannical, authoritarian states that the modern world has ever seen. I mean, and a lot of this really, particularly the Hitler chapter, was not known until my book came out, because, in truth, the Koch Industries, you have to remember, this family's business is a privately owned company. It's huge. It's the second largest private company in America, yet very little is known about it, mostly because there are no stockholders, and only two brothers really own almost all of it. It's doing $115 billion a year of business. It's selling everything from Lycra to Stainmaster Carpet to refining tons of oil, and has tar sands in Canada and Dixie Cups and Georgia Pacific Lumber. I mean, so many different products. So what I wanted to do, it's called A Hidden History. I wanted to tell the story so people in the country can evaluate and understand, where is this coming from?
Well, let me pick up on the Soviet Stalin part of it, because Fred Koch was, the founder, or certainly a founder, of the John Birch Society, a very anti-communist. In fact, they thought Eisenhower was a communist. That's how right-wing they were. And here he is doing business with Stalin.
Well, in some ways, I mean, one comes from the other. What people I interviewed said was, after Fred Koch made a fortune during the Depression in the U.S. by working for Stalin, he came back and became quite guilty about it. And people he knew who he'd worked with were being killed by Stalin's, you know, operatives. And so he then became staunchly anti-communist and obsessive about it, which is what the John Birch Society was, of course. So he was one of the nine original founders of the John Birch Society, and he brought up his sons in this very extreme political environment where, as you say, they saw communist conspiracies behind everything, whether it was Eisenhower's presidency or John F. Kennedy. The other thing that they looked at as a communist conspiracy was integration in America. So that the Father Koch wrote an article in which he described welfare and integration policies as means of fomenting race war in America. They were going to draw black people into the cities, he said, and they were going to start a vicious race war. There's a lot of very strange, far out, and quite racist thinking that was associated with the early John Birch Society, and that's the environment in which these boys grew up. Actually, two of them, Charles and David Koch, were both members of the John Birch Society along with their father.
Well, let me move to another chapter, and this is something called the Powell Memo or Powell Memorandum, something that you write about in this book, Jane, about I don't exactly know how to describe it, but this takes us back to the early 70s, 1971. What is the Powell Memo?
So this was what interested me about this is we think what we're looking at now in terms of very far-right politics in the Republican Party is new, but it goes back years, decades, really. And in the 1970s, there was a counter movement brewing to what I don't know how many of your listeners remember, but there was the environmental movement had taken place. Ralph Nader was pushing the consumer movement, and there was a kind of a general sense that there was public interest law firms and all of these kinds of new things going on that corporate America was very unhappy with. And Powell was a lawyer for the tobacco companies from Richmond, Virginia. And he wrote a memo for the Chamber of Commerce that was supposed to remain secret that's like a battle plan. It's a blueprint that says corporate America is endangered by these movements and we have to fight back. What interested me is in this memo, he defines the enemy not as like the hippies in the streets or the anti-war protesters. The enemy, he says, is elite public opinion. It's the universities, it's the judges on the benches, it's the scientists, it's the preachers in the pulpits, it's newspapers and intellectuals. And what he says is, if corporate America is going to fight back, we have to take that over or create our own. And we're going to have to start getting corporate America to fund it so that we can get control of this and change how Americans think.
Well, you write about the number of endowed, I guess, chairs or departments in universities since that time. We've got these think tanks. We've got Cato. I guess that was created by Koch. Heritage, AEI. Is that all sort of an offshoot of this memo or memorandum?
In many ways, it is. And so what you've got is, I mean, it's a small group of people. Powell was in a little social club with Richard Mellon Scaife, who was an heir to the Gulf Oil fortune. He's from Pittsburgh. And I got a hold of his unpublished memoir, which is fascinating. And he says he funded 133 of the 300 most important right-wing groups that came out of this thing. And he pours his fortune into it. He has a private foundation, so when he gives contributions, he takes tax deductions for this, and he builds up very consciously, following the blueprint from Powell, a counterintelligentsia. So all those think tanks, all these programs in universities, that he works with other superbly wealthy American families who have private foundations, like the Bradley Foundation and the Olin Foundation, and they make a big push on the universities, and they start also the Federalist Society, a right-wing legal society that's become very important, and generally just sort of try to build up, promote their point of view, mostly in a tax-deductible way.
Well, that's what's interesting is the creation of either philanthropies or nonprofits or charities, that was a way that this money has been funneled?
Yeah, people talk about how they weaponized philanthropy. And, these private foundations in the beginning of America were very controversial when John Rockefeller started the first one. And they were supposed to stay out of politics in exchange for their tax deductions that the people who run them get. But what you see is this became increasingly political and very purposefully so. And so they use these tax-deductible private foundations to wage basically a war on liberalism and against kind of the idea that government can do good in this country.
Well, I'm thinking of Citizens United. That takes us up to more present day. But what are they, 501c4s? I mean, these are the nonprofits that are supposed to not coordinate with candidates, but nonetheless have pretty powerful impact, lots of money and anonymity in their favor.
Right. And so what we're seeing now with these 501c4s, which are supposed to be called social welfare groups, according to the IRS, and they're not supposed to be principally involved in politics, but it's an extension of what began back when they started using these foundations in this way on the right, you know, a couple decades ago. But the, now the 501c4 is the just become a tremendous sort of slush fund way of funding politics. The book's called Dark Money because those groups are dark, meaning Americans who want to know who's putting money into this these projects, you cannot find out who the donors are because they're supposed to be charitable groups. And we try to hide the names of charitable donors to give them some privacy. But in fact, they've become tremendously important political influences. So even just in the Koch organization alone, over a four-year period, they put almost $500 million into these dark money groups recently. And that packs a punch in American politics.
Well, and it raises questions about the parties. I mean, whether they are, quote unquote, a bigger threat to the Republican Party, taking over some of their, what, ideas and candidates, or whether they're a bigger threat to the Democratic Party. Have you thought about that?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And one of the things that I'd like to say, because I think people need to know that a number of the critics of the Kochs, particularly, who I quote in this book, are Republicans. So particularly moderate Republicans who feel they've been targeted for not wanting to go along with everything that, the Kochs and their donor group want. So you have Steve Lofgren, who was a congressman from Ohio, saying he left politics because he couldn't stand it anymore. The money was driving everything, and it was driving it to such an unreasonable place. He felt he couldn't really be a useful part of the government anymore. And then that's Steve LaTourette. And then you've got Mike Lofgren. Mm-hmm. Steve LaTourette was the congressman from Ohio, and then Mike Lofgren was somebody who'd worked on Capitol Hill for many years on the Senate Budget Committee, and he describes how he feels like this big money group is almost kind of seceding from America. They have their own interests at heart as opposed to what the rest of the country needs.
Does that explain the permanent campaign that they're – and it's not just the Koch brothers or Koch Industries, but just that the political system is so awash with money now that we are in a – we're always in some kind of a endless campaign.
Well, I think, you know, what interested me about this group is just that they're not elected. So you're used to kind of a permanent campaign now between Republicans and Democrats, maybe. But you've got a kind of a privatized permanent campaign against governing that is coming from this small group. And let's talk about that group for one second.
Sure.
It's not just the Koch brothers. You know, the Koch brothers are enormously wealthy in their own right. Each brother has a fortune that's now been estimated to be $45 billion. So together they've got $90 billion, just these two individuals. But what makes them so smart in the way they've approached politics is they've gathered around them something like 400 or 500 extraordinarily rich people who have pooled their resources. So they've been able to put together this kind of war chest. That group, it's only 400 or 500 people in this country, but it, of course, exerts disproportionate power because of its financial throw weight.
Are you saying they make it impossible or hard to govern in this country?
Well, on some issues where this group has really exerted influence, it's had some serious success, I would say. It's not on every issue, and it's not in every election. It's much more about issues, really, than it is about elections. Some they win, some they lose. To take one issue, many of the people in that group of 400 or 500 are in the fossil fuel business one way or the other. And they have cumulatively impacted what Congress does or doesn't do about climate change. You see the rest of the world and most of science all going in one direction saying, this is a serious problem. We better do something about it before it's too late. And then you have the U.S. Congress doing nothing about it And you also have a pledge that the Kochs themselves have created that 156 members of Congress have signed, promising not to do anything about climate change. These are people who ran for office with Koch backing, and they signed this pledge. So you can literally see hands being tied by big money on that particular issue.
That was my conversation with investigative journalist and staff writer for The New Yorker, Jane Mayer, about her book, Dark Money. And that wraps up this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Liz Fiedler, Trine Nouri, and John Ahrens, who edits the show. I'm Marty Moscoing. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.